good morning and welcome to Manzanita Voices. I'm your host, Linda Field, and you have found the radio show for writers, for people who love to write or people who love to read books, anybody who loves the written word. And if you'd like to get the background on how, on what's behind some of the poetry books or novels that you like to read, this is the place to come, because I talk to different writers every week. I'd like to announce that Manzanita Writers Press is sponsoring a workshop that's coming up this February, February 25th, 2012, in San Andreas. That's on Highway 49 in Calaveras County. The workshop will feature Antoinette May, and she will be giving a lesson on travel writing for magazines. But she says that her workshop is also going to translate to how to write about different localities and places that will work into your novel and make your novel more interesting. So if you want to learn about Antoinette, if you're not familiar, she's a writer who's very prolific. She's published several historical novels, and she has been a newspaper writer, columnist for years and years. She writes for the San Francisco Chronicle sometimes, for the newspapers here in Calaveras County. And she had a couple of travel books that she published years ago. So she's a perfect one to teach a class about travel writing. The other person giving the workshop that day, which is February 25th, will be Linda Abbott Trapp. You may remember she was a guest on this show. Antoinette and Linda have both been guests on this show. And Linda is a psychologist, teacher of writing, and author of several books. And her topic in this workshop is going to be writing to heal. I think it's going to be a very interesting, worthwhile, and perhaps therapeutic class to take. So if you're interested in attending this workshop, we have it set up so you can come and attend all day long for one price, which I can't remember what it is, or you can take one class but not the other. And you can get all the details on that at www.manzapress.com. That's our website, and you'll find all the particulars there. I'm not sure that we've put up the information on the workshop, so if you go to manzapress.com and you don't find the information yet, please check back in a week or so. It will be there. Also, my website, manzamedia.com, has a lot of these Manzanita Voices shows archived, so you can listen to them. And my blog is also there. I'd love to have you go and check that out. And if you want to email me, you can do that at linda@manzamedia.com. Again, everything is built around the word Manzanita, if you notice. So that makes it easy to remember. One of the reasons you might want to email me would be to send something for me to read that you have written for our morning workout. And that's what I'm going to be doing right now. I had a listener send in a really touching poem. Diana Henning sent a poem called "The One with Violets in Her Lap." And she put in here that the title is by Sappho. And so we Googled that and found that Sappho wrote a long, long, long time ago a poem that did not completely survive, but one of the lines in the poem was "The One with Violets in Her Lap." So that's where the title comes from. And Diana has, she's got quite an impressive biography here. She's had her work appear in Crazy Horse, The Lullwater Review, Poetry International, Fugue, the Asheville Poetry Review, and others. She has taught creative writing for California poets in the schools. She was the recipient of a 2008 California Humanities Stories Grant, and she has written a book called The Broken Bone Tongue. It was published by Black Buzzard Press in Austin, Texas. So, Diana, thank you so much for sending this poem in. And again, anybody out there who would like to have your work read on the air, that's how you do it. Linda@manzamedia.com. Okay, here's Diana's poem, the one with violets in her lap. If she were someone else's sister, I would make her mine, twist her bones into recognition, the catacombs of her eyes, deep and memorable. If she were lost, I would surely find her, coax her back, the same way she returned with each push on the playground swing. My studio clock, a mercenary of bad news, intones its message. She won't return. The one who survives is the one left behind. Beautiful poem. Thank you, Diana. All right. Well, now it is time for me to introduce my guests. And today, we have two for the price of one. I have my first show with two guests with me today, Hatch and Taylor Graham from Placerville. And a lot of you folks are aware of these people. They really get around a lot. They're very active in the community and have been for a long, long time doing various things. And I just want to welcome you both. Welcome, Taylor.
Thank you.
And Hatch.
Glad to be here.
Oh, I'm glad to have you both here. Hatch has been in the Forest Service. That was his career for many years. And that is how he and Taylor met. He was telling me the story of how you guys met. You want to tell that?
Well, actually, I was working on the San Bernardino National Forest. And in the evenings, I was teaching a vocational education class at a community college, and it seemed like every time I gave a test, there was some Judy Taylor who always got 100% on it. And after a field session, we stopped at a little community beer parlor with the older students, and I asked her where she learned to drink beer, and she said, "Oh, in Germany, when I was working on my Fulbright master's degree." So that explained why she could get 100% on everything. And it wasn't too long until became a romance and she became my wife.
Oh, that's wonderful. And how long have you been married now?
I'll ask her. Yeah.
It'll be 40 years next month.
Fabulous. Congratulations for that. That's good.
Right. I'm glad she reminded me of 40 years and the anniversary coming up.
It went so fast, didn't it? It just went so fast. You didn't think it was that long. Yeah. Now, Taylor, you and Hatch both, but I think primarily you have been involved with search and rescue with dogs for, you said, over 25 years.
We started in 1975, and actually Hatch was active at first, and I was sort of a camp follower, but I couldn't stand it, and I had to train a dog of my own. So we've been doing it. We're pretty much retired now, except you can't explain retirement to a dog, so we still train every week.
Oh, you do? You still keep them keep them on their toes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We would have no peace in the family.
Oh. they want to work.
Yeah, absolutely. It's their life.
Oh, my gosh. Huh. Now, you were talking earlier with me about the fact that you've done searches in Virginia, and have you gone all over the country to help search and rescue, or did you live back in Virginia?
Hatch was stationed actually in the Washington, D.C. office, but we lived in rural Virginia for almost 5 years, and we searched there. We started in Alaska and searched there.
Oh, my.
And then came back home to California. We were called, for instance, to the Mexico City earthquake in 1985. The first time our government had sent a rescue as opposed to a recovery team abroad.
Oh, my. So, and were you able to help find some people there?
Well, we searched for 5 days, and we have a report of at least one survivor that our dogs found. But the situation was we would be called to a site, and we would search and report what we found, and then we were sent someplace else, and we never found out what happened. Where we had already searched, except in one case.
Oh, I see. So your dogs indicated that there was possibly someone alive in that spot.
Right.
And then they sent you on to some other place while they dug the person. Wow.
Of course, our dogs indicated many, many dead people, but it was our mission was to find the live ones.
Yeah, yeah. It must be emotionally very hard work, but very satisfying as well.
It was hard emotionally on the dogs as much as anyone.
You know, I've heard that. I've heard that the dogs really.
My dog found. We went into one building, and there were probably 75 people that had been killed in that building, and she just shut down. Her ears drooped, and she didn't want to search anymore.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah.
Wow.
We had to hide a live person in a place and let her find him, so she would come back to work.
So she could feel that she was being successful.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. They're such sweet dogs. There is a beautiful poster that was in my veterinarian's office when I lived in Sacramento. Fabulous poster. I think of a fireman and a search and rescue dog that must have been painted after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
It's a golden retriever. And it's a beautiful painting, and always brought tears to my eyes when I saw it, because the dog and the fireman looked very crestfallen, and it must have been a hard time for them. Of course, our time is gone already. We've finished our first segment. We'll be right back though with more from Taylor Graham and Hatch Graham, and we're going to hear some of their poetry. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. Our guests today are Taylor Graham and her husband Hatch. And we were talking about search and rescue before the intermission here. And Taylor, it just must be a tremendously emotional experience to take your dogs out on searches, because they're not always successful. And it must be really, really hard when you don't find the person you're looking for. And you told me how that ties in with the writing of the poetry then.
Yeah, when you find somebody and the search concludes and everybody's happy, you go home and, you know, it doesn't prey on your mind. But if there's no conclusion to the search, or if the person doesn't survive, you always wonder what you might have done better, or anyway, that's what preys on your mind, and that's where the poems come from, I think. At least most of my poems are not happy search poems.
Yeah, I can see how that would happen. Yeah, the ones you write about are the ones that give you the most pain.
Yeah.
You have a chapbook there with a picture on the cover of yourself and one of your dogs in a training session, but it looks pretty darn real. You're being lowered into, looks like a tunnel by a cable.
Yeah, we're being lowered in harness down into the depths of something. It's a training session for disaster work. For instance, if we were getting ready to go to an earthquake, we get the dogs accustomed to being put in all sorts of strange situations and be confident so that they can go on with their business of searching and not be worried about how they're dangling in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, they have to get used to a lot. How about reading a poem or two from that chapbook?
Sure. This poem actually is based on several searches for little lost boys when we lived in Virginia. And I actually wore out a compass navigating through the Virginia woods because they're so dense. You have to keep taking compass readings like every 2 feet just to keep on a straight line.
Wow.
So the sort of sense of claustrophobia in those woods is not like anything here that I've experienced. Anyway, this poem is called "He Was Wearing a Yellow T-Shirt." We search for child paths in the woods. Where would he go? Cedars bunch gray and blind with cobwebs, berries and honeysuckle, shoulder up higher than a man, not a boy. Birds only sing from the tops and edges, warblers, orioles. Flicks of yellow foliage trick the eye, not a boy. We could be in Transylvania, the Yucatan, backwoods of a suburb. Where is he? Who walked out of his house and down the civilized street and out of the world? He's finding the way roots pull the red clay over and quilted creepers. Every long bone loosened from its muscle, moving the way stones and twigs do, the intricate small bones of fingers easing out of their joints. By fall, it will all be second nature to him, how the blonde hairs scatter. When it rains, won't matter. Snow melts and runs away, kid stuff. And spring shoves up a few yellow tatters, flowers that never grew on a stalk.
Oh, that was a touching story about looking for the boy. And you said that was a composite of several searches where you looked for children.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you have another one that I've heard. It happens to be a poem that's in our Manzanita Wild Edges book that came out in 2010. And that is also about one of your search and rescue experiences. Would you read that for us, Taylor?
Well, again, it probably draws on quite a number of searches, because it's a poem I wrote several years after I had done any of these searches. But it is from our Sierra High Country. How to find the place. At the trailhead, check the ground for sign, scuffs or arrows, footprints. Remember, trails deceive. Don't trust rocks that hikers pile as markers. They've been lost. Forget logic. The place you're headed has no X on the map. If the men in charge knew where to find him, they'd already be there. Past the waterfall, keep climbing switchbacks to the fork. Take the lesser path by intuition, the one that promises no view, but disappears in willow thicket quick with warblers. A stream entwines meadow, hellebore, lupin, columbine. Now find the opening that pulls you, not a swale exactly, just a wish to follow. Feel how it draws without intent. You've climbed so far to get here. Two great boulders like a gate, the sudden vista. This is where he'd stop to get out his camera, where he'd focus on the world through his lens, stepping without looking a bit to the left or to the right for the best shot, not seeing the edge.
You really have to be a psychologist when you're looking for someone, don't you? You have to think about where would they go, what would they do.
You do, and you're always thinking about if he were here, what would draw him? And there are places in the mountains where you think you know where you're going, but you find that the land is drawing you a certain way in spite of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I wrote this poem, thinking of how you can just be taken by the landscape someplace you didn't intend to go.
Hmm. Have you ever been lost?
For short times, yes.
But that's why you carry a compass.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't even trust your compass because it seems to be wrong.
Are they ever wrong?
Probably not. Well, there was a place where I think there may have been a lot of metal maybe buried in the ground by settlers and so forth. That something that was seemed to be kind of messing things up with my compass. But there's certainly a psychology to lost person behavior that, and searchers can fall into it too.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet they can. And I would imagine that if someone is lost for a longer and longer time, they may begin to panic and become erratic, and
definitely.
Following them then really becomes difficult. What's your advice for people who get lost?
What stop. Don't get any farther lost. Wait to be found. Write big help signs or something in case a helicopter's going over.
We used to teach a course for little kids called Hug a Tree.
Right.
And they're still teaching it. If you get out there, make a sign as big as you can that says help, and then hug a tree.
And make it your best friend and don't leave it.
That's right.
Okay, well, we'll be back in just a couple minutes with more from Taylor and Hatch, so stay tuned. We're back at Manzanita Voices with Taylor and Hatch Graham. And before I forget, Taylor, tell everybody how to get in touch with you at your website and how to buy your book, because we're going to be talking in a few minutes about Walking with Elihu, the book that you've published. How will people get that?
Well, Walking with Elihu, they can find on Amazon. And our website includes information about my various chapbooks as well as Elihu, and our website is www.somersetsunset.net.
Somersetsunset.net.
Includes business about our search and rescue.
Oh, good. Right. Must be an interesting website, so that'll be a good one to go and check out.
Pictures of all our old search dogs.
Oh, how great. She's smiling as she says that, like she's talking about her kids. So, S-O-M-E-R, set. Sunset.
Right.
SomersetSunset.com.
.net.
.net. Ooh, I always
rhymes with Somerset and
Sunset. That's right. So that's a good way to remember it. Okay, and Walking with Elihu, which you're going to hear in our last segment today, is at Amazon.com.
Right.
Okay, now, you live in Placerville, and Taylor started a poetry group there years ago, and Hatch was telling me that he has been driven to poetry ever since.
That's right.
Explain that, Hatch, driven to poetry.
Well, I always enjoyed poetry and reading poetry when I was in high school and even after, but after I married a poet and she started this workshop, I had to go, and so my eyes are bad now, and so she drives, and so I was driven to poetry, all right. And some of the poetry that we had, she makes assignments. And one assignment was to write a poem in the style of someone you really admired, some other poet. And so when I was in high school, I really loved Rudyard Kipling's British in India poetry. Mm-hmm. And one of them was Gunga Din. And a lot of you probably have heard Gunga Din. It was Din, 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 you Lazarushan leather Gunga Din, etc. So I thought, well, I'll write a poem in the style of Gunga Din, but I have to have a story. And what story do I have that fits? Well, in 1959, I worked on the range on the Kings River Ranger District in the Sierra National Forest, and I had a horse, and we had a job that was being done in the high country at 10,000 feet, and people don't forget the Donner Party. After the first snow falls, you better get out of the country, because otherwise the next snow may be belly up to a horse. And so I had a horse, and I had a situation with a fence crew at 10,000 feet. So this was my story in the style of Gunga Din.
Okay.
It's called Blaze Wins the Race. You speak of horses great and fast while reading of the Derby last, and tell of Man of War and Seattle Slough. But when it comes to packing, you'll soon find they're lacking, and you'll bet your paycheck on only very few. It started in the summer, and I thought the horse a bummer, bought by our local trail crew foreman. He was flighty and a craze, and we had to call him Blaze. He was tall and lanky, and his nose was Roman. It was Blaze, 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 you lanky bag of mule bones, skinny Blaze. Here's oats, you simple dummy, come fill your gall-darn tummy, you crossbred swayback sorrel, bony Blaze. The season did progress, and he weighed less and less. The vet came up at last and wormed him. The hose went down his throat. The juice would fill a boat. But by the fall, old Blaze was fit and trim. We were riding hours on the range, and it didn't seem too strange to see that he could really cover ground. He'd come now to my shout from where'er he was about, and you could depend for sure that you'd be found. It was Blaze, 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 you ugly maverick, you only want to graze. It's time to saddle up. Come on now, hup, hup, hup. We've got miles to make it to the river, Blaze. His long legs would really cover ground, often after dark, before a camp was found. And he'd stand by as I unsaddled him, as I unpacked our mule and fed them oats, cooked dinner, finished off my notes. He'd graze unhobbled, 'cause I trusted him. Morning when I shook the sack and whistled, he was back. And he'd puff up when we cinched the girth, and though he'd often try to squash my boot, he was a gentle old recruit, though many years well past his birth. It was Blaze, Blaze, Blaze when I couldn't see just where he'd gone to graze, and thought our hobbled mule had played us for a fool. Here coming from the willows is faithful Blaze. I'll not forget the night when I'd ridden from first light with 7 rented horses to haul the fence crew in. The snow had started falling, the weather was appalling, and we had strange horses where they'd never been. Hobbled them and grained them late, huddled in a tent we could only wait. As morning dawned, no horses could be seen. With the trail covered by a foot of snow and a 14-mile way to go, I set out with ropes and thoughts obscene. It was Blaze, 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 you traitor! Where are you in this maze? With no traces on the ground, how can you e'er be found? I thought I could trust you, damn you, Blaze. The day and I were cold and gray, when from a thicket came a neigh, and my white-faced sorrel trotted into sight. He snuffled up his grain, I mounted bareback with a strain, and headed down the trail to catch the ones in flight. Soon rounded up and fed, back to the camp we led, greeted by the crew with heartfelt praise. They'd had a serious fright of another freezing night, and were glad I'd put my trust in good old Blaze. Yes, Blaze, 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 your Roman-nosed old lanky sorrel Blaze, gone now, but we all know the answer. You weren't no native dancer, but in my book You won the race, my good old Blaze.
Yeah, Blaze must have been a great horse who fooled you in the beginning.
He turned out to be faithful, and as I said, the...
pretty smart.
We got out of there. I can remember a time later when the people weren't so lucky, and they had to hike out through waist-high snow because they hadn't gotten out soon enough.
Oh, that would be awful. That would be just awful. You've seen some wonderful country. You've been in the mountains and in the forests and had a great life for somebody born in Los Angeles.
Well, I always wanted to be a ranger from the time I was probably about 6.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What inspired you to be a ranger at that age?
Oh, I have a poem about that, but I don't think you have time to hear it all.
Oh, let's see. Well...
Essentially, to make the long story short, four of us little boys were gathering cigarette butts and were going to roll our own up in the brush-covered canyon of Beverly Glen. If anyone knows the Santa Monica Mountains, no one tries to light a match in that country. But
because of fire danger.
Oh yeah,
and
oh, we were there about starting to roll our own when this. Fire warden plunks his feet right in front of me, and I've got a poem about this, but it takes too much time. But essentially, I was very much impressed by this fire warden at the time I was 6, even though he confiscated our cigarette makings and told our parents.
I can imagine 4 little 6-year-old boys about ready to light a cigarette out there in the out there in the tinder dry country. Oh my goodness!
I figured the storekeeper squealed on us. Who could a 6-year-old trust? You know.
Oh my! Well, hey Hatch, do you have another that's maybe shorter that you could read?
Because
I'd love to hear some more of your poetry. I can see that Taylor has rubbed off on you.
I think I probably. Could read one about raising dogs.
Okay.
Or surreal.
Hmm?
Surreal. Is
which one?
Surreal.
Surreal?
I'm not sure.
Go ahead and take your time and find it. We'll just
Post Corral.
Post Corral? Oh, well, that's another horse poem, but it's not about our dogs.
Well, that's true, but it's about the forest.
Okay, well. My wife... obviously likes that, but I was going to read the circling of the pack.
Okay, you can read that one.
Yeah, read the one you want.
Yeah, this was another assignment from our Tuesday at 2 poetry session to write a pontoum, which is a Malaysian form that came by way of 19th century France and is now done by people, sort of a circular arrangement of lines and so forth, and it just seemed to fit our dogs at the time. We had 3 of them, and at dinner time, this is what I called circling of the pack. Around the kitchen, the pack is all gathered. Mama sets breakfast down on the floor. Cody and Piper and Cowboy all circle. Who has the best? What is the score? Breakfast is set down on the floor. Cowboy's is special, so he doesn't like it. Who has the best? What is the score? Cody says Cowboy's is good, so she'll take it. Cowboy's is special, so he doesn't like it. Piper tries Cody because it's not hers. Cody says Cowboy's is good, so she'll take it. But Piper's in hers, and she's hoping for more. Piper tries Cody's because it's not hers. Cowboy thinks Piper's is actually best. But Piper's in his, and he's hoping for more. Mama says Cowboy's is special for puppies. Cowboy thinks Piper's is actually best. Mama says Cowboy's is special for puppies. Around the kitchen, the pack is all gathered. Cody and Piper and Cowboy still circle.
I love that. Oh, my gosh. I used to have 3 dogs, Max, Bandit, and Foxy, and I can just see them. Yeah, they are so funny at feeding time. Now, Taylor, we have just a couple minutes left. Would you tell me what again was the form of that poetry? Because I'm not familiar with that.
It's a pontoum.
And
Well, the lines keep repeating. From the lines from one stanza come down to the next.
And you build on a kind of an intricate design. Yeah.
But the net result is a lot of repetition.
A lot of repetition, which you chose a perfect subject for that hatch, for that form of poem, because I can just see those dogs circling around and trying everybody else's food. And now your poetry group meets Tuesdays at 2. In fact, that's the name of the group, right?
Right.
So people can remember it.
That's right.
And where does it meet?
It meets, right now it meets at the Pizza Factory in Placerville. We started in 1999 in Pollock Pines, and we've had various homes, but we've been now at the Pizza Factory for probably 2 or 3 years, and looks like we're going to stay there.
Okay, and that's on North Broadway in Placerville.
Right.
Are people welcome to come and join you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
They just have to be sure that they're ready to write a poem, because we write a poem at every session.
That's right. We have a pretty much standard at the end of the session. Each of us draws a word from a can, and then we all use all of those words to write a poem.
Oh, that must be fun.
We usually have between 6 and 8 words that we have to fit in. And, you know, one word might be polyester or amoeba. Or.
Well, everybody has a polyester amoeba at home, so that would be easy.
That's right. And if they didn't before, they do now in their poem.
Right. Okay, well, we'll be back in just a couple minutes with more from Taylor. We're going to hear about walking with Elihu. So stay tuned. We're back with Manzanita Voices, and on this segment we're going to hear Taylor Graham tell about her book, Walking with Elihu. And I had not heard of this person, Elihu Burritt. He was a 19th century peace advocate, but he began his life's work in New Britain, Connecticut. He was a blacksmith's apprentice. He taught himself mathematics, astronomy, 50 languages, and all of this while he stood working at that hot forge. Must have been quite a person. So Taylor's going to tell us more about Elihu and read us some of the poems she wrote about this person. How did you find out about him?
Well, from the time I was just a little tiny girl, I was told by my mother that I had a famous relative, Elihu Burritt, the learned blacksmith who taught himself 100 languages. Well, that was a gross exaggeration. It was only 50 languages.
Oh, my goodness.
But so I grew up with this sort of legendary figure, and it took me, close to 60 years, I guess, to get curious enough to investigate and start researching him and writing poems about him. And when I did, he became an obsession.
Because how did you find out about him after letting 60 years go by so that a lot of people were no longer around that you could ask?
The Internet is a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is. So,
I really did. I got started with my research on the Internet and found all sorts of good material. And interlibrary loan is another wonderful tool.
Mm.
If I had a lot of money and were able to travel, I would have gone back to New Britain, Connecticut, and looked into the Elihu Burritt Library at the Central Connecticut State University, the library named after him, where they have a lot of primary materials, his journals and so forth. And also there's quite a collection at Swarthmore. but I stayed here in California and did what I could.
Did it long distance.
Yes, and fortunately, Elihu wrote many books of his travels, especially also essays on behalf of his causes, for instance, peace.
He walked
the length of Britain, yes, just to see. Well, this was during the Industrial Revolution, and he wanted to see what innovations there were in agriculture and manufacturing and so forth. He really got into the nitty-gritty of details of things like that. And he wanted to see how the common people lived, and he liked to see things up and personal.
And then he wrote it all down.
He wrote a journal of his travels, yes.
Yeah. Now, you told me something interesting. He was giving a paper in France, and he wrote his paper in French, and then he had to have someone else read it.
Right. He traveled to Europe to work for peace, and he helped organize a series of international peace congresses over there. And the second one was in Paris, and he was one of the main speakers, and he wrote out his speech. But then all of his language studies had been in libraries, and just on his own, he hadn't actually spoken French. So he gave his speech to a Frenchman to present.
Because he didn't know how to pronounce the words.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably figured that the speech would be more persuasive if delivered by somebody who was comfortable speaking the language.
Amazing man. Well, tell me, let us hear some of your book and tell us what you're going to read.
Okay, this poem is based on one day's entry in Elihu's journal in 1838. He was working as a journeyman blacksmith in Worcester, Massachusetts. And he was living there partly because he could find work, but also because the Antiquarian Society had a library of ancient languages. And so he was using the library, and he was actually given a key to the library because as a blacksmith he was working at his trade when the library was open. So he would go on off hours and study all these various languages. So the title is 10 Hours at the Forge. And then by lantern light you read 60 lines Hebrew, 30 pages French, its phrases springing from the page as fluently as the river Seine you've yet to see, 10 pages Cuvier's theory, 8 lines Syriac. And who besides yourself in this township or the state to understand? 10 lines Danish, 10 ditto Bohemian, 1 line less of Polish. That night you memorize 15 names of stars. So much to learn when one is pupil and master too. A poor man's university, where each hammer stroke helps solve a question you pose mathematically. The bellows breathe in Latin and Greek. The flames feed your own philosophy. In time, you'll learn to read 50 human languages and translate each of them to peace, the word you'd write on every tongue.
Were you able to find out from any of your relatives what it was that drove him to become, he's a very industrious man, but to learn 50 languages on his own? Do you know anything about his personality?
Just that he believed that a man could, with hard work, could make himself whatever he wanted to be. In fact, he went on the lecture circuit while he was still working as a blacksmith, and his first lecture was on self-improvement, how just any kid could teach himself anything.
Which is true.
Well.
But not many do.
Not many do. I'll tell you, before I really got excited about Elihu way back in ninth grade, I bought myself a secondhand Greek grammar, and I was going to teach myself Greek.
Oh, it runs in the family.
I learned the alphabet. And that was about it.
Well, that's a lot more than I know.
Actually, she really couldn't talk to anyone of her relatives because their genealogy is such that he was her fourth cousin four times removed. I ran the genealogy up, and you got to go back to her great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was also his great-great-great-great-grandfather, but through a whole different line.
Oh, my.
Well, Elihu never married, and he never had children because he had an awful lot of other things to do, I guess.
I guess so. Yeah, pretty amazing man. Okay, let's hear something more.
Okay. With his travels through Britain and his writing about it, I've been struck by some of his observations that make me think he was kind of a precursor of environmentalism in a way. He could see the changes that were coming in Britain, and he could see that some of it was very good and some of it was kind of scary. And this poem, this one was actually written while he was serving as President Lincoln's consular agent in Birmingham, England, which was a very industrialized part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he visited a coal mining town. And this poem is in form of a villanelle, which is another of these forms that uses a lot of repetition. There are two lines that keep repeating through the poem.
Okay.
And in his book, Walks in the Black Country, he writes, "The furnace and forge buildings with all their chimneys have sunk from being undermined. This is a characteristic feature of the black country in this coal mining district."
Hmm.
So, "To fire the forge. This whole town's built on under-tunneled ground where coal pays wages. Here's the collier's door. It sinks so gently, you don't hear a sound. Beneath, they dig with pick. With sledge, they pound away toward deeper buried seams, black ore. This whole town's built on under-tunneled ground where roofs that settle day by day astound. The steeple's lost another inch or more. It sinks so gently you don't hear a sound. Through passages by torchlight, iron-bound, the miners delve toward hell or planet's core. This whole town's built on under-tunneled ground that cannot hold. Though greening hills surround, their roots can't stay the tide, nor timber's shore what sinks so gently you don't hear a sound. No word of outrage, just earth's sigh profound at what our tools have wrought and can't restore. The whole town's built on under-tunneled ground that sinks so gently you don't hear a sound."
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and I want you to read one more. So while you're finding that, Taylor, I'm going to review how people can get in touch with you. They go to, for your website, www.somersetsunset.net. And that Somerset is S-O-M-E-R, set. And don't forget, if you live in the Placerville area, go and check out the poetry sessions that happen Tuesday at 2 at the Pizza Factory on North Broadway in Placerville. Come prepared to write some poetry and have a lot of fun. And also, please send me your emails with embedded poetry or short fiction so that I can read it on the air for morning workout. And that would be at linda@manzamedia.com. Okay, you have one more for us, huh, Taylor? Let's go.
Just quick background here. Another of Elihu's causes was what he called ocean penny postage, to try to make overseas mail affordable for poor people, because there was a lot of immigration to America, and families couldn't afford to keep in touch because the overseas postage was so expensive. So This poem is called Cosmologies. It's the 21st century, Elihu. How can I write you 150 years ago? I don't even know the letter rate back then. No matter. Our topic is timeless. Peace. The imaginable unknown. You always believed it could happen. Think of the old Greek and Roman gods, their immortal jockeying for position in the pantheon. Forever embroiling us poor mortals. A goddess scorned and Troy goes up in flames. And then the Bible. Remember, as a child, you loved to read of holy battles. David, psalmist of peace, smiting the Philistines and Amalekites. Israel against Judah in civil war. In your own day, war between the states. Now we've got Palestine, Iraq, war, war, and again war. In your ageless other world, has anyone invented a telescope to spy a godlier universe for man, one that lies beyond the vision of history, science, myth? In what solar system is there a sun called Love, with its planets, brotherhood, and peace?
Taylor Graham, from her book Walking with Elihu. If you want to get that book, it's available on Amazon. I want to thank both of you, Taylor and Hatch, for coming today and sharing your talents with us. It was really an interesting conversation. I wish we had three or four times as much, because there's so much more to talk about. Don't forget the chapbooks that Taylor has written are available on her website too, and that would be really good. I'm interested in the one about the rescue dogs, and that's only one of them, right? You have several chapbooks.
Yes.
Okay. Well, time to leave you for this time. Come back and see us next week. This is Linda Field. Have a great day.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.